I guess that gives you a bargaining chip when it comes to getting rid of the number for Mahout. Hell, maybe I just won't pay them anything at all until they get rid of that bastard. The union is powerful. Another scream shakes the factory, making Anderson flinch. And stupid! He glances toward the observation windows. What the hell are they doing to that animal? He motions at Hak-Sung. Go check on them. Hak-Sung looks as if he will argue, but Anderson fixes him with a glare. The old man gets to his feet. A resounding trumpet of protest interrupts whatever complaint the old man is about to voice. The observation windows rattle violently. What the? Another trumpeted wail shakes the building, followed by a mechanical shriek, the power train seizing. Anderson lurches out of his chair and runs for the window, but Hak-Sung reaches it ahead of him. The old man stares through the glass, mouth agape. Yellow eyes, the size of dinner plates, rise level with the observation window. The megadont is up on its hind legs, swaying. The beast's four tusks have been sawn off for safety, but it is still a monster. 15 feet at the shoulder, 10 tons of muscle and rage balanced on its hind legs. It pulls against the chains that bind it to the winding spindle. Its trunk lifts, exposing a cavernous maw. Anderson jams his hands over his ears. The megadon scream hammers through the glass. Anderson collapses to his knees, stunned. Christ! His ears are ringing. Where's that Mahout? Hak-Sung shakes his head. Anderson isn't even sure the man has heard. Sounds in his own ears are muffled and distant. He staggers to the door and yanks it open, just as the megadont crashes down on spindle 4. The power spindle shatters. Teak shards spray in all directions. Anderson flinches as splinters fly past, and his skin burns with needle slashes. Down below, the Mahouts are frantically unchaining their beasts and dragging them away from the maddened animal, shouting encouragement, forcing their will on the elephantine creatures. The megadonts shake their heads and groan protest, tugging against their training, overwhelmed by the instinctual urge to aid their cousin. The rest of the Thai workers are fleeing for the safety of the street. The maddened megadont launches another attack on its winding spindle. Spokes shatter. The Mahout, who should have controlled the beast, is a mash of blood and bone on the floor. Anderson ducks back into his office. He dodges around empty desks and jumps another, sliding over its surface to land before the company's safes. His fingers slip as he spins combination dials. Sweat drips in his eyes. 23 right, 106 left. His hand moves to the next dial as he prays that he won't screw up the pattern and have to start again. More wood shatters out on the factory floor, accompanied by the screams of someone who got too close. Hak-Sung appears at his elbow, crowding. Anderson waves the old man away. Tell the people to get out of here! Clear everyone out! I want everyone out! Hak-Sung nods but lingers as Anderson continues to struggle with the combinations. Anderson glares at him. Go! Hak-Sung ducks acquiescence and runs for the door, calling out, his voice lost in the screams of fleeing workers and shattering hardwoods. Anderson spins the last of the dials and yanks the safe open. Papers, stacks of colorful money, eyes-only records, a compression rifle, a spring pistol. Yates. He grimaces. The old bastard seems to be everywhere today. As if his pea is riding on Anderson's shoulder. Anderson pumps the handgun spring and stuffs it in his belt. He pulls out the compression rifle, checks its load as another scream echoes behind. At least Yates prepared for this. The bastard was naive, but he wasn't stupid. Anderson pumps the rifle and strides for the door. Down on the manufacturing floor, blood splashes the drive systems and QA lines. It's difficult to see who's died. More than just the one Mahout. The sweet stink of human offal permeates the air. Gut streamers decorate the Megadon's circuit around its spindle. The animal rises again, a mountain of genetically engineered muscle, fighting against the last of its bonds. Anderson levels his rifle. At the edge of his vision, another Megadon rises onto its hind legs, trumpeting sympathy. The Mahouts are losing control. He forces himself to ignore the expanding mayhem and puts his eye to the scope. His rifle's crosshairs sweep across a rusty wall of wrinkled flesh. Magnified with the scope, the beast is so vast, he can't miss. He switches the rifle to full automatic, exhales, and lets the gas chamber unleash. A haze of darts leaps from the rifle. Blaze orange dots pepper the Megadon's skin, marking hits. Toxins, concentrated from Agrigen research on wasp venom, pump through the animal's body, gunning for its central nervous system. Anderson lowers the rifle. Without the scope's magnification, he can barely make out the scattered darts on the beast's skin. In another few moments, it'll be dead. The Megadon wheels and fixes its attention on Anderson, eyes flickering with Pleistocene rage. Despite himself, Anderson is impressed by the animal's intelligence. It's almost as if the animal knows what he's done. The Megadon gathers itself and heaves against its chains. Iron links crack and whistle through the air, smashing into conveyor lines. A fleeing worker collapses. Anderson drops his useless rifle and yanks out the spring gun. It's a toy against 10 tons of enraged animals, but it's all he has left. The Megadon charges and Anderson fires, pulling the trigger as quickly as his finger can convulse. Useless bladed discs spatter against the avalanche. The Megadon slaps him off his feet with its trunk. The prehensile appendage coils around his legs like a python. Anderson scrabbles for a grip on the door jamb, trying to kick free. The trunk squeezes. Blood rushes into his head. He wonders if the monster simply plans to pop him like some blood-bloated mosquito, but then the beast is dragging him off the balcony. Anderson scrabbles for a last handhold as the railing slides past, and then he's airborne, flying free. The Megadon's exultant trumpeting echoes as Anderson sails through the air. The factory floor rushes up. He slams into concrete. Blackness swallows him. Lie down and die. Anderson fights unconsciousness. Just die. He tries to get up, to roll away, to do anything at all, but he can't move. Colorful shapes fill his vision, trying to coalesce. The Megadon is close. He can smell its breath. Color blotches converge. The Megadon looms, rusty skin and ancient rage. It raises a foot to pulp him. Anderson rolls onto his side but can't get his legs to work. He can't even crawl. His hands scrabble against the concrete like spiders on ice. He can't move quickly enough. Oh, Christ, I don't want to die like this. Not here, not like this. He's like a lizard with its tail caught. He can't get up. He can't get away. He's going to die. Jelly. Under the foot of an oversized elephant. The Megadon groans. Anderson looks over his shoulder. The beast has lowered its foot. It sways, drunken. It snuffles about with its trunk, and then abruptly its hind quarters give out. The monster settles back on its haunches, looking ridiculously like a dog. Its expression is almost puzzled. A drugged surprise that its body no longer obeys. Slowly its forelegs sprawl before it, and it sinks, groaning, into straw and dung. The Megadont's eyes sink to Anderson's level. They stare into his own, nearly human, blinking confusion. Its trunk stretches out for him again, slapping clumsily. A python of muscle and instinct, all uncoordinated now. Its maw hangs open, panting. Sweet furnace heat gusts over him. The trunk prods at him, rocks him, can't get a grip. Anderson slowly drags himself out of reach. He gets to his knees, then forces himself upright. He sways, dizzy, then manages to plant his feet and stand tall. One of the Megadont's yellow eyes tracks his movement. The rage is gone. Long-lashed eyelids blink. Anderson wonders what the animal is thinking. If the neural havoc tearing through its system is something it can feel. If it knows its end is imminent. Or if it just feels tired. Standing over it, Anderson can almost feel pity. The four ragged ovals where its tusks once stood are grimy foot-diameter ivory patches savagely sawed away. Sores glisten on its knees and scabious growths speckle its mouth. Close up and dying, with its muscles paralyzed and its ribs heaving in and out, it is just an ill-used creature. The monster was never destined for fighting. The Megadont lets out a final gust of breath. Its body sags. People are swarming all around Anderson, shouting, tugging at him, trying to help their wounded and find their dead. People are everywhere. Red and gold Union colors, green Spring Life livery, the Mahouts clambering over the giant corpse. For a second, Anderson imagines Yates standing beside him, smoking a nightshade and gloating at all the trouble. "And you said you'd be gone in a month." And then Hawk Sung is beside him, whisper voice and black almond eyes and a bony hand that reaches up to touch his neck and comes away, drenched red. "You're bleeding," he murmurs. Chapter 2. "Lift!" Hak Sung shouts. Palm and Nu and Kukrit and Kanda all lean against the shattered, winding spindle, drawing it from its cradle like a splinter pulled from the flesh of a giant, dragging it up until they can send the girl Mai down underneath.
"I can't see,"
she shouts. Palm and Nu's muscles flex as they try to keep the spindle from reseating itself. Hak Sung kneels and slides a shake light down to the girl. Her fingers brush his, and then the LED tool is gone, down into the darkness. The light is worth more than she is. He hopes they won't drop the spindle back into its seat while she's down there.
"Well," he calls down a minute later, "is it cracked?"
No answer comes from below. Hak Sung hopes she isn't caught, trapped somehow. He settles into a squat as he waits for her to finish her inspection. All around, the factory is a hive of activity as workers try to put the place back in order. Men swarm over the Megadon's corpse. Union workers with bright machetes and four-foot bone saws, their hands red with their work as they render down a mountain of flesh. Blood runs off the beast as its hide is stripped away, revealing marbled muscle. Hak Sung shudders at the sight, remembering his own people, similarly disassembled. Other bloodlettings, other factory wreckage. Good warehouses destroyed, good people lost. It's all so reminiscent of when the green headbands came with their machetes and his warehouses burned. Jute and tamarind and kink springs, all going up in fire and smoke, slick machetes gleaming in the blaze. He turns his eyes away, forcing down memories, forces himself to breathe. As soon as the Megadont Union heard one of their own was lost, they sent their professional butchers. Hawksung tried to get them to drag the carcass outside and finish their work in the streets to make room for the power train repairs, but the Union people refused. And so now, in addition to the buzz of activity and cleanup, the factory is full of flies and the increasing reek of death. Bones protrude from the corpse like coral rising from an ocean of deep red meat. Blood runs from the animal, rivers of it, rushing toward the storm drains and Bangkok's coal-driven flood control pumps. Hawksung watches sourly as blood flows past. The beast held gallons of it, untold calories rushing away. The butchers are fast, but it will take them most of the night to dismember the animal completely.
"Is she done yet?"
Palm gasps. Hawksung's attention returns to the problem at hand. Palm and Nu and their compatriots are all straining against the spindle's weight. Hawksung again calls down into the hole.
"What do you say, Mai?"
Her words are muffled.
"Come up, then."
He settles back on his haunches, wipes sweat off his face. The factory is hotter than a rice pot. With all the Megadonts led back to their stables, there is nothing to drive the factory's lines or charge the fans that circulate air through the building. Wet heat and death stench swaddle them like a blanket. They might as well be in the slaughter grounds of Klong Toi. Hawksung fights the urge to gag. A shout rises from the Union butchers. They've cut open the Megadon's belly. Intestines gush out. Awful gatherers, the Dung Lord's people, all, wade into the mass and begin shoveling it into handcarts, a lucky source of calories. With such a clean source, the offal will likely go to feed the pigs at the Dung Lord's perimeter farms, or stock the yellow card food lines, feeding the Malayan Chinese refugees who live in the sweltering old expansion towers under the Dung Lord's protection. Whatever pigs and yellow cards won't eat will be dumped into the methane composters of the city, along with the daily fruit rind and dung collections, to bake steadily into compost and gas, and eventually light the city streets with the green glow of approved burn methane. Hawksung tugs at a lucky mole, thoughtful. A good monopoly, that. The Dung Lord's influence touches so many parts of the city, it's a wonder that he hasn't been made Prime Minister. Certainly if he wanted it, the godfather of godfathers, the greatest Zhao Po to ever influence the kingdom, could have anything he wanted. But will he want what I have to offer? Hawksung wonders. Will he appreciate a good business opportunity? Mai's voice finally filters up from underneath, interrupting his ruminations.
"It's cracked!"
she shouts. A moment later, she claws her way out of the hole, dripping sweat and covered with dust. Nu and Palm and the rest release their hemp ropes. The spindle crashes back into its cradle, and the floor shakes. Mai glances behind her at the noise. Hawksung thinks he catches a glimpse of fear, the realization that the spindle could have truly crushed her. The look is gone as quickly as it came. A resilient child.
"Yes?"
Hawksung asks.
"Go on. Is it the core that is split?"
"Yes, Kun. I can slide my hand into the crack this far."
She shows him, touching her hand nearly at her wrist.
"And another on the far side, just the same."
"Come, Mavda."
Hawksung curses. He's not surprised, but still.
"And the chain drive?"
She shakes her head.
"The links I could see were bent."
He nods.
"Get Lin and Lek and Chuan."
"Chuan is dead."
She waves toward the smears, where the Megadon trampled two workers. Hak-Sung grimaces.
Yes, of course.
Along with Noi and Kapipon and unfortunate Banyat, the QA man, who will never now hear Mr. Anderson's irritation that he allowed lime contamination in the algae baths. Another expense. 1,000 baht to the dead workers' families and 2,000 for Banyat. He grimaces again.
Find someone else then. Someone small from the cleaning gang like you. You will be going underground. Palman Nguyen Kukrit. Get the spindle out. All the way out. We will need to inspect the main drive system link by link. We cannot even consider starting again until it has been checked. What's the rush?
Palm laughs.
It will be a long time before we run again. The Farang will have to pay the union bags and bags of opium before they're willing to come back. Not after he gunned down Haprit. When they do return, we won't have number 4 spindle.
Hak-Sung snaps.
It will take time to win an approval from the crown to cut another tree of this diameter, and then to float the log down from the north, assuming the monsoon comes at all this year. And all that time we will be running under constrained power. Think about that. Some of you will not be working at all.
He nods at the spindle.
The ones who work hardest will be the ones who stay.
Palm smiles apologetically, hiding his anger, and whys.
Kun, I was loose with my words. I meant no offense. Good then.
Hak-Sung nods and turns away. He keeps his face sour, but privately, he agrees. It will take opium and bribes, and a renegotiation of their power contract, before the Megadonts once again make their shuffling revolutions around the spindle cranks. Another red item for the balance sheets. And it doesn't even include the cost of the monks, who will need to chant, or the Brahmin priests, or the feng shui experts, or the mediums who must consult with the P so that workers will be placated and continue working in this bad luck factory.
Pan Xiangcheng.
Hak-Sung looks up from his calculations. Across the floor, the Yangweza, Anderson Lake, is sitting on a bench beside the workers' lockers, a doctor tending his wounds. At first, the foreign devil wanted to have her sew him up upstairs, but Hak-Sung convinced him to do it down on the factory floor, in public, where the workers could see him, with his white tropical suit covered with blood like a pea out of a graveyard, but still alive at least, and unafraid. A lot of face to be gained from that. The foreigner is fearless. The man drinks from a bottle of Mekong whiskey that he sent Hak-Sung out to buy, as if Hak-Sung was nothing more than a servant. Hak-Sung sent Mai, who came back with a bottle of fake Mekong, with an adequate label, and enough change to spare that he tipped her a few baht extra for her cleverness, while looking into her eyes and saying,
"Remember that I did this for you."
In a different life, he would have believed that he had bought a little loyalty when she nodded solemnly in response. In this life, he only hopes that she will not immediately try to kill him, if the ties suddenly turn on his kind and decide to send the yellow-card Chinese all fleeing into the blister-rusted jungle. Perhaps he has bought himself a little time, or not. As he approaches, Dr. Chan calls out in Mandarin,
"Your foreign devil is a stubborn one, always moving around."
She's a yellow card like him. Another refugee forbidden from feeding herself, except by wits and clever machinations. If the white shirts discovered she was taking rice from a Thai doctor's bowl, he stifles the thought. It's worth it to help someone from the homeland, even if it is only for a day. An atonement of sorts for all that has gone before.
Please try to keep him alive.
Hak-Sung smiles slightly.
We still need him to sign our pay stubs.
She laughs.
Ting Mafan. I'm rusty with a needle and thread, but for you, I'd bring this ugly creature back from the dead.
If you're that good, I'll call for you when I catch Sibiscosis.
The young Gweza interjects in English. What you complaining about? Hak Sung eyes him.
You move about too much.
She's damn clumsy. Tell her to hurry up.
She also says you are very, very lucky. Another centimeter difference and the splinter cuts your artery. Then your blood is on the floor with all the rest.
Surprisingly, Mr. Lake smiles at this news. His eyes go to the mountain of meat being rendered down.
A splinter. And I thought it was the Megadon that was going to get me. Yes, you nearly died,
Hak Sung says. And that would have been disastrous. If Mr. Lake's investors were to lose heart and give up the factory, Hak Sung grimaces. It is so much harder to influence this young Gweza than Mr. Yates, and yet this stubborn foreign devil must be kept alive, if only so that the factory will not close. It's an irritating realization that he was once so close to Mr. Yates and now so far from Mr. Lake. Bad luck and a stubborn young Gweza. And now he must come up with a new plan to cement his long-term survival and the revival of his clan.
You should celebrate your survival, I think,
Hak Sung suggests.
Make offerings to Kuan Yin and Budai for your very good luck.
Mr. Lake grins, his pale blue eyes on Hak Sung. Twin, watery devil pools. You damn right I will. He holds up the bottle of fake Mekong, already half gone. I'll be celebrating all night long.
Perhaps you would like me to arrange a companion.
The foreign devil's face turns to stone. He looks at Hak Sung with something akin to disgust. That's not your business. Hak Sung curses himself, even as he keeps his face immobile. He has apparently pushed too far, and now the creature is angry again. He makes a quick whine of apology.
Of course, I do not mean to insult you.
The young Gweza looks out across the factory floor. The pleasure of the moment seems drained from him.
How bad is the damage?
Hak Sung shrugs.
You are right about the spindle core. It is cracked.
And the main chain?
We will inspect every link. If we are lucky, it will only be the sub-train that is affected.
Not likely. The foreign devil offers him the whiskey bottle. Hak Sung tries to hide his revulsion as he shakes his head. Mr. Lake grins knowingly and takes another pull, wipes his lips on the back of his arm. A new shout rises from the Union Butchers as more blood gushes from the Megadont. Its head lies at an angle now, half severed from the rest of the body. More and more, the carcass is taking on the appearance of separated parts. Not an animal at all, more a child's playset for building a Megadont from the ground up. Hak Sung wonders if there's a way to force the Union to cut him in on the profits they get from selling the untainted meat. It seems unlikely, given how quickly they staked out their space, but perhaps when their power contract is renegotiated, or when they demand the reparations.
Will you take the head?
Hak Sung asks.
You can make a trophy of it.
No. The young Gweza looks offended. Hak Sung forces himself not to grimace. It's maddening to work with the creature. The devil's moods are mercurial and always aggressive, like a child. One moment joyful, the next petulant. Hak Sung forces down his irritation.
Mr. Lake is what he is.
His karma has made him a foreign devil, and Hak Sung's karma has brought them together. It's no use complaining about the quality of you techs when you're starving. Mr. Lake seems to catch Hak Sung's expression and explains himself. This wasn't a hunt. It was just an extermination. As soon as I hit it with the darts, it was dead. There's no sport in that.
Ah, of course. Very honorable.
Hak Sung stifles his disappointment.
With the foreign devil demanding the head, he could have replaced the stumpy tusk remainders with coconut oil composites and sold the ivory to the doctors near Wat Bawornawet. Now, even that money will be gone. A waste. Hak Sung considers explaining the situation to Mr. Lake, explaining the value of meat and calories and ivory lying before them, then decides against it. The foreign devil would not understand. And the man is too easy to anger as it is.
The Cheshires are here. Mr. Lake comments. Hak Sung looks to where the Yang Guize indicates. At the periphery of the bloodletting, shimmering feline shapes have appeared. Twists of shadow and light, summoned by the carrion scent. The Yang Guize makes a face of distaste, but Hak Sung has a measure of respect for the devil cats. They're clever, thriving in places where they're despised, almost supernatural in their tenacity. Sometimes it seems that they smell blood before it is even spilled, as if they can peer a little way into the future and know precisely where their next meal will appear. The feline shimmers stealth toward the sticky pools of blood. A butcher kicks one away, but there are too many to really fight, and his attack is desultory. Mr. Lake takes another pull of whiskey. We'll never get them out.
There are children who will hunt them,
Hak Sung says.
A bounty is not expensive.
The Yang Guize makes a face of dismissal. We have bounties back in the Midwest, too.
Our children are more motivated than yours.
But Hak Sung doesn't contest the foreigner's words. He'll put out the bounty regardless. If the cats are allowed to stay, the workers will start rumors that Pi Oun, the Cheshire trickster spirit, has caused the calamity. The devil cats flicker closer. Calico and Ginger, black as night, all of them fading in and out of view as their bodies take on the colors of their surroundings. They shade red as they dip into the blood pool. Hak Sung has heard that Cheshires were supposedly created by a calorie executive, some per-cal or agrigen man, most likely, for a daughter's birthday. A party favor for when the little princess turned as old as Lewis Carroll's Alice. The child guests took their new pets home, where they mated with natural felines, and within 20 years, the devil cats were on every continent, and Felis domesticus was gone from the face of the world, replaced by a genetic string that bred true 98% of the time. The green headbands in Malaya hated Chinese people and Cheshires equally. But as far as Hak Sung knows, the devil cats still thrive there. The Yang Guize flinches as Dr. Chan sticks him again and he gives her a dirty look. "Finish up," he says to her. "Now." She whispers, carefully hiding her fear.
"He moved again,"
she whispers to Hak Sung.
"The anesthetic is not good. Not as good as what I am used to."
"Don't worry,"
Hak Sung replies.
"That's why I gave him the whiskey. Finish your work. I will deal with him."
To Lake Shensheng, he says,
"She is almost finished."
The foreigner makes a face but doesn't threaten her anymore, and at last the doctor completes her sewing. Hak Sung takes her aside and hands her an envelope with her payment. She wires her thanks, but Hak Sung shakes his head.
"There is a bonus in it. I wish you to deliver a letter as well."
He hands her another envelope.
"I would like to speak with the boss of your tower."
"Dogfucker,"
She makes a face of distaste.
If he heard you call him that, he'd destroy whatever's left of your family.
He's a hard one.
Just deliver the note. That will be enough.
Doubtfully, she takes the envelope.
You've been good to our family. All the neighbors also speak of your kindness. Make offerings to your loss.
What I do is too little.
Hak-sung forces a smile.
Anyway, we Chinese must stick together. Perhaps in Malaya we were still Hokkien or Hakka or Fifth Wave, but here we are all yellow carts. I am embarrassed I cannot do more.
It is more than anyone else.
She whys to him, emulating the manners of their new culture, and departs. Mr. Lake watches her go. She's a yellow card, isn't she? Hak-sung nods.
Yes. A doctor in Malacca. Before the incident.
The man is quiet, seeming to digest this information.
Was she cheaper than a Thai doctor?
Hak-sung glances at the young Gwaizi, trying to decide what he wants to hear. Finally, he says,
Yes, much cheaper. Just as good, maybe better, but much cheaper. They do not allow us to take Thai niches here, so she has very little work except for yellow cards, who of course have too little to pay. She is happy for the work.
Mr. Lake nods thoughtfully and Hak-sung wonders what he's thinking. The man is an enigma. Sometimes Hak-sung thinks young Gwaizi are too stupid to have possibly taken over the world once, let alone twice. That they succeeded in the expansion and then, even after the energy collapse, beat them back to their own shores, that they returned again with their calorie companies and their plagues and their patented grains, they seem protected by the supernatural. By rights, Mr. Lake should be dead. A bit of human offal, mingled with the bodies of Banyat and Noi, and the nameless, stupid number 4 spindle Megadont handler who caused the beast to panic in the first place. And yet, here, the foreign devil sits, complaining about the tiny prick of a needle, but completely unconcerned that he has destroyed a 10-ton animal in the blink of an eye. The young Gwaizi are strange creatures indeed. More alien than he suspected, even when he traded with them regularly.
The Mahout will have to be paid off again, bribed to come back to work,
Hak-sung observes.
Yes. And we will have to hire monks to chant for the factory, to make the workers happy again. Pi must be placated.
Hak-sung pauses.
It will be expensive. People will say that your factory has bad spirits in it, that it is sited wrong, or that the spirit house is not large enough, or that you cut down a peace tree when it was built. We will have to bring a fortune teller, perhaps a feng shui master, to get them to believe the place is good. And then the Mahout will demand hazard pay.
Mr. Lake interrupts. I want to replace the Mahout, he says. All of them. Hak-sung sucks air through his teeth.
It is impossible. The Megadont Union controls all of the city's power contracts. It is a government mandate. The White Shirts award the power monopoly. There is nothing we can do about the unions.
They're incompetent. I don't want them here.
Not anymore.
Hak-sung tries to tell if the Farang is joking. He smiles, hesitantly.
It is a royal mandate. One might as well wish to replace the environment ministry.
There's a thought. Mr. Lake laughs. I could team up with Carlisle and Sons and start complaining every day about taxes and carbon credit laws. Get Trade Minister Akira to take up our cause. His gaze rests on Hak-sung.
But that's not the way you like to operate, is it?
His eyes become abruptly cold.
You like the shadows and the bargaining. The quiet deal.
Hak Sung swallows. The foreign devil's pale skin and blue eyes are truly horrific. As alien as a devil cat, and just as comfortable in a hostile land.
It would be unwise to enrage the White Shots,
Hak Sung murmurs.
The nail that stands up will be pounded down.
That's yellow card talk.
As you say, but I am alive when others are dead, and the Environment Ministry is very powerful. General Pracha and his White Shots have survived every challenge, even the December 12th attempt. If you wish to poke at a cobra, be ready for its bite.
Mr. Lake looks as if he will argue, but instead shrugs.
I'm sure you know best.
It is why you pay me.
The young Guizis stares at the dead Megadont. That animal shouldn't have been able to break out of its harness. He takes another drink from his bottle. The safety chains were rusted, I checked. We aren't going to pay a cent of reparations. That's final. That's my bottom line. If they had secured their animal, I wouldn't have had to kill it.
Hak Sung inclines his head in tacit agreement, though he will not speak it out aloud.
Kun, there's no other option.
Mr. Lake smiles coldly.
Yes, of course. They're a monopoly.
He makes a face.
Yates was a fool to locate here.
Hak Sung experiences a chill of anxiety. The young Guizis suddenly looks like a petulant child. Children are rash. Children do things to anger the White Shirts or the Unions, and sometimes they pick up their toys and run away home. A disturbing thought indeed. Anderson Lake and his investors must not run away. Not yet.
What are our losses to date?
Mr. Lake asks. Hak Sung hesitates, then steels himself to deliver bad news.
With the loss of the Megadont and now the cost of placating the Unions, 90 million baht perhaps?
A shout comes from Mai, waving Hak Sung over. He doesn't have to look to know it's bad news. He says,
There will be damage below as well, I think. Expensive to repair.
He pauses, touches the delicate subject.
Your investors, the Mr. Greg and Yi, will have to be notified. It is likely that we do not have the cash to do repairs and also to install and calibrate the new algae baths when they arrive.
He pauses.
We will require new funds.
He waits anxiously, wondering what the young Guizis' reaction will be. Money flows through the company so quickly, sometimes Hak Sung thinks of it as water, and yet he knows this will not be pleasant news. The investors sometimes become balky at expenses. With Mr. Yates, the fights over money were common. With Mr. Lake, less so. The investors do not complain so much now that Mr. Lake has arrived, yet it is still a fantastic amount of money to spend on a dream. If Hak Sung ran the company, he would have shut it down more than a year ago. But Mr. Lake doesn't blink at the news. All he says is, more money. He turns to Hak Sung.
And when will the algae tanks and nutrient cultures clear customs?
He asks.
When really?
Hak Sung blanches.
It is difficult. Parting the bamboo curtain is not something done in a day. The Environment Ministry likes to interfere.
You said you paid to keep the White Shirts off our backs.
Yes.
Hak Sung inclines his head.
All the appropriate gifts have been given.
So why was Banyat complaining about contaminated baths? If we've got live organisms breeding.
Hak-sung hurries to interrupt. Everything is at the anchor pads, delivered by Carl Island Sons last week.
He makes a decision. The Yangwezi needs to hear good news.
Tomorrow the shipment will clear customs. The bamboo curtain will part, and your shipment will arrive on the backs of megadonts.
He makes himself smile.
Unless you wish to fire the union right now.
The devil shakes his head, even smiles a little at the joke, and Hak-sung feels a flush of relief. Tomorrow, then. For certain? Mr. Lake asks. Hak-sung steals himself and inclines his head in agreement, willing it to be the truth. Still, the foreigner holds him with his blue eyes. We spend a lot of money here. But the one thing the investors can't tolerate is incompetence. I won't tolerate it either.
I understand.
Mr. Lake nods, satisfied. Good then. We'll wait to talk with the home office. After we've got the new line equipment out of customs, we'll call. Give them some good news with the bad. I don't want to ask for money with nothing to show at all. He looks at Hak-sung again.
We wouldn't want that, would we?
Hak-sung makes himself nod.
As you say.
Mr. Lake takes another drink from his bottle.
Good.
Find out how bad the damage is. I want a report in the morning. With this dismissal, Hak-sung heads across the factory floor to the waiting spindle crew. He hopes that he is right about the shipment, that it will be truly released, that he will be proven right by events. It's a gamble, but not a bad one, and the devil would not have wanted to hear too much bad news at once in any case. When Hak-sung arrives at the winding spindle, Mai is dusting herself off from another foray into the hole.
How does it look?
Hak-sung asks. The winding spindle is fully disengaged from the line. Now drawn forth, it lies on the ground, a massive spike of teak. The cracks are large and obvious. He calls down the hole.
A lot of damage!
A minute later, Palm crawls out covered in grease.
Those tunnels are tight, he gasps. I can't fit down some of them.
He wipes the sweat and grime with an arm.
It's the sub-train for certain, and we won't know about the rest until we send children down along the links. If the main chain is damaged, we'll have to pull up the floor.
Hak-sung peers into the revealed spindle hole with a grimace, flashing back to tunnels and rats and cowering survival in the jungles of the south.
We'll have Mai find some of her friends.
He surveys the damage again. He owned buildings like this once. Whole warehouses filled with goods. And now look what he is. A factotum for Yangwezi. An old man with a body that's falling apart and a clan that has been filed down to his single head. He sighs and forces down frustration.
I want to know everything about how bad the damage is before I talk to the Farang again.
No surprises. Palm wise.
Yes, Kun.
Hak-sung turns for the offices, limping slightly for the first few steps before forcing himself not to favor the leg. With all the activity, his knee aches, a reminder of an encounter of his own with the monsters that drive the factory. He can't help stopping at the top of the steps to study the megadont carcass, the places where the workers died. Memories scratch and peck at him, swirling like black crows, hungry to take over his head. So many friends dead, so much family gone. 4 years ago, he was a big name.
Now nothing. He pushes through the door. The offices are silent. Empty desks. Expensive treadle computers. The treadmill and its tiny communication screen, the company's massive safes. As he scans the room, religious fanatics in green headbands leap from the shadows, machetes whirling. But they are only memories. He closes the door behind him, shutting out the sounds of butchery and repair, forces himself not to go to the window and look down again on the blood and carcass, not to dwell on memories of blood running down the gutters of Malacca, of Chinese heads stacked like durians for sale. This is not Malaya, he reminds himself. You are safe. Still the images are there. As bright as photographs and spring festival fireworks. Even with the incident, 4 years in the past, he must perform calming rituals. When the feeling is bad, almost any object reminds him of menace. He closes his eyes, forces himself to breathe deeply, to remember the blue ocean and his clipper fleets white upon the waves. He takes another deep breath and opens his eyes. The room is safe again. Nothing but empty desks set in careful rows and dusty treadle computers. Shutters blocking out the blaze of tropic sunlight, dust motes and incense. Across the room, deep in shadows, the twinned vaults of Spring Life safes gleam dully, iron and steel, squatting there, taunting him. Hak Sung has keys to one, the petty cash safe, but the other, the great safe, only Mr. Lake can open. So close, he thinks. The blueprints are there, just inches away. He has seen them laid out. The DNA samples of the gene-hacked algae, their genome maps on solid-state data cubes. The specifications for growing and processing the resulting skim into lubricants and powder. The necessary tempering requirements for the kink spring filament to accept the new coatings. A next generation of energy storage sits within his grasp. And with it, a hope of resurrection for himself and his clan. Yates mumbled and drank, and Hak Sung filled his baijiu glass and listened to his rambles and encouraged his trust and dependence for more than a year, and it was all a waste. Now it comes down to this safe that he cannot open because Yates was foolish enough to raise the investor's ire and too incompetent to bring his dream to fruition. There are new empires waiting to be built. If only Hak Sung can reach the documents, all he has are incomplete copies from when they used to sit in the open, splashed across Yates's desk before the drunken fool bought the cursed office safe. Now there is a key and a combination, and a wall of iron between him and the blueprints. A good safe. Hak Sung is familiar with its sort. Benefited from its security when he too was a big name and had files he needed to protect. It is irritating, perhaps more irritating than anything else, that the foreign devils use the same brand of safe as he used for his own trading empire in Malaya. Ying Ti. A Chinese tool, twisted to foreign purposes. He has spent days staring at that safe. Meditating on the knowledge that it contains. Hak Sung cocks his head, suddenly thoughtful. Did you close it, Mr. Lake? In all the excitement, did you forget perhaps to lock it closed once again? Hak Sung's heart beats faster. Did you lapse? Mr. Yates sometimes did. Hak Sung tries to control growing excitement. He limps across to the safe, stands before it. A shrine, an object of worship, a monolith of forged steel impervious to everything except patience and diamond drills. Every day he sits across from it feels it mocking him. Could it be as simple as this? Is it possible that in the rush of disaster that Mr. Lake simply forgot to close it? Hak-Sung reaches out hesitantly and puts his hand on the lever. He holds his breath. Prays to his ancestors. Prays to the elephant-headed Prakkanet, the Thai people's remover of obstacles, to every god he knows. He leans on the handle. 1,000 jin of steel push back, every molecule resisting his pressure. Hak-Sung lets out his breath and steps back, forcing down his disappointment. Patience. Every safe has a key. If Mr. Yates had not been so incompetent, if he had not somehow angered the investors, he would have been the perfect key. Now it must be Mr. Lake instead. When Mr. Yates installed the safe, he joked that he had to keep the family jewel safe and laughed. Hak-Sung had made himself nod and why and smile, but all he could think about was how valuable the blueprints were, and how stupid he had been not to copy faster when they had been easily available. And now Yates is gone, and in his place a new devil. A devil truly, blue-eyed and gold-haired and hard-edged, where Yates was soft. This dangerous creature who double-checks everything Hak-Sung does and makes everything so much harder, and who must somehow be convinced to give up the secrets of his company. Hak-Sung purses his lips. Patience. You must be patient. Eventually, the foreign devil will make a mistake. Hak-Sung! Hak-Sung goes to the door and waves down to Mr. Lake, acknowledging the summons. But instead of going downstairs immediately, he goes to his shrine. He prostrates himself before the image of Kuan Yin and begs that she will have mercy on him and his ancestors, that she will give him a chance to redeem himself and his family. Beneath the golden character for good fortune, suspended upside down so that it will gush down upon him, Hak-Sung places Yutex rice and cuts open a blood orange. The juice runs down his arm, a ripe one, clean of contamination and expensive. One cannot cut too close to the bone with gods. They like the fat, not the lean. He lights incense. As smoke streams into the still air, filling the office once again, Hak-Sung prays. He prays that the factory will not close, and that his bribes will bring the new line equipment through the bamboo curtain without difficulty. That the foreign devil, Mr. Lake, will lose his head and trust him too much. And that the cursed safe will open and reveal its secrets to him. Hak-Sung prays for luck. Even an old Chinese yellow card needs luck. Chapter 3. Emiko sips whiskey, wishing she were drunk, and waits for the signal from Kanika that it is time for her humiliation. A part of her still struggles against it, but the rest of her, the part that sits with her midriff-bearing mini-jacket and tight pasin skirt and a glass of whiskey in her hand, doesn't have the energy to fight. And then she wonders if she has it backwards. If the part that struggles to maintain her illusions of self-respect is the part intent upon her destruction. If her body, this collection of cells and manipulated DNA, with its own stronger, more practical needs, is actually the survivor, the one with will. Isn't that why she sits here, listening to the throb of beating sticks and the wail of piklang as girls writhe under glowworms and men in horrors shout their encouragement? Is it because she lacks the will to die, or because she's too stubborn to allow it? Raleigh says that all things come in cycles.
like the rise and fall of the tides along the beaches of Koh Samet.